Hello and welcome to Strangers Stopping Strangers, podcast number 32. Thank you so much for tuning in. A big welcome back to anybody who's returning, and thanks for stopping in to anybody who's new this week. This week's podcast, I get an opportunity to hear and share the stories and music selections from Susanna Millman. We met last fall when she and her husband, Dennis McNally, were out here on the East Coast at the Dark Star Orchestra Show in Northampton, spreading the word of her new book, Alive with the Dead, or A Fly on the Wall with a Camera. The book is filled with pictures and stories from the late 70s all the way up to current times. And on this podcast, Susanna brings the pictures and stories to life for us, along with some meaningful songs that resonate. It was such a pleasure getting to know her, and really just such an honor to get to share her stories with you on the podcast. And, you know, as always, lots of laughs along the way. And be sure to go check this book out because, you know what they say, a picture is worth a thousand words, and there are a lot of beautiful pictures in this book. So, as always, thank you so much for tuning in. Enjoy, and we'll catch you next week. Well, Susanna, thank you so much for joining Stranger Stopping Strangers.
I'm happy to be here, Stacey. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Everyone's going to be so excited to hear your story because, I mean, it's such a rich story, you know, with all of the characters. And I mean, your book, you know, is just such a beautiful visualization with some stories behind it. So excited to get it live
Thank you.
Well, we met in person in Northampton at the Dark Star Orchestra show. So you were out and about, and that was so much fun. So you did a bit of a fall tour.
We did a bit of a fall tour on the East Coast, starting in D.C. and Pennsylvania at the Ardmore, and then a bunch with Dark Star in the New York and New England area. And by sheer coincidence, or synchronous magic, call it what you will, tonight we'll see it starts our round two with Dark Star again at the University of California Theater in Berkeley. They're here for three nights.
Oh gosh, I couldn't be more homesick if I tried right now. I wish I could just blink my eyes and be in California. Oh my God, that's so
fun. I wish you could too, but. It is what it is. What can we say?
It is. Absolutely. Well, let's dive into your story. You know, we picked out some songs and, you know, again, read through the book and there's kind of some stories, but I want to hear you, you know, tell everyone a little bit about it. So, you know, start in the 70s. I know kind of in the book you started talking about, you know, sort of how your life had changed when you were traveling. And, let's hear a little bit about that.
Okay, I'm one of these deadheads who got on the bus quite late, and that would be in the early 70s, so I missed the days of the folks like Rosie McGee, who Dennis calls the first called, and I went to South America to study shamanism. I was teaching psychology in New York. I was a very linear person, and I hooked up with a bunch of deadheads who were from the Bay Area, and they talked about the Grateful Dead all the time, and there was a lot of dead music playing, and we were riding horseback across the Andes, and life was 1 minute to the next with dead music in the background, and I was really into the on tape, you know, on some kind of weird tape devices. I really got into the improvisational, more spontaneous lifestyle, which led me to understand the Grateful Dead's music a lot better. 74, I came back to the United States, and I came back to California because that's where the Grateful Dead were, and I really wanted my life to hook up with theirs. And if that was in my mind, at least strongly in the back of my mind. So that's my story in the 70s, and it all happened fairly magically in the years that followed. So in came back and actually got out here, that was when they were taking their hiatus. But shortly after that, I got tickets magically to 12/29/77. And I would say that that's the night I really became a deadhead, and it's also the night I met Dick and Carol Lotvala. So Dick was my first serious introduction into the world of the Grateful Dead and deadheads and what it, you know, and the depth of what it meant to be a deadhead. And I will add, it was very funny. Well, a little bit later in the early 80s, I was at Dick's house in West Marin, and Dennis McNally, who I did not know yet, Paul Grushkin, who unfortunately just passed away, were there, and they were having this insanely academic Grateful Dead conversation. And I couldn't believe that deadheads were really into this, you know, and it was kind of the academic thing that I had gotten away from. So that was that was something, was all I can say. And in retrospect, I, and I'm sure many other deadheads, are very, very grateful for that approach and for Dead Base. And I do want to give a shout out to Dead Base because for helping me remember a lot of when I took these pictures and what song must have been playing, judging by the light and stuff like that. So God bless Stu Nixon and Mike Del Gushkin and their partner in doing Dead Base.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's amazing because, you know, I feel like it is such a juxtaposition between, you know, it being a moment by moment and a, you know, the whimsical improvisation of the music and then the technical layers that people
right.
really can. I mean, you can really go down and the ways that the songs are never replicated and who's taking lead and what's going on and the way they interact. I mean, you can look at it as just from both angles and they would both be correct. You know?
That's true. It's all true. That just proves that everything that's going on at the same time is
going on. Yeah,
<That's>
exactly.
<right.
laughs> Well, I'm more of a "but you get confused listening to the music play" kind of a girl.
Right.
I've got to be honest. I'm not the most technical girl in town. I mean, you know, I get I can listen and pick an era and I, you know, the lyrics and the songs, but I come about it from more of a social aspect than a
Understood. Understood. I'm not musically technical either. I'm technical reasonably with cameras and computers, and but with the music, I leave it to the professionals like Healy, Brainlove, Howard Danchik, the ultrasound guys. I love those guys.
Yeah. Well, again, it takes everything to make it complete.
That's, yep.
Well, on this podcast, we play music, and,
okay.
And so you gave me a list of music because, you know, I want to hear the stories, but I want to hear the music that goes with it because it all goes
absolutely.
Back to music. So the show that you picked was this show, was December 29th, 1977, and you said, "Let's hear a little Bobby." So we pulled out "Looks Like Rain."
Oh, nice.
So I'm going to go ahead and play that for the listeners, and then when we come back, we're going to go into the 80s, and that's a decade with a lot of meat on the bones, so I'm excited to get
that's
in.
That's a fact. Okay.
So everybody enjoy Looks Like Rain, and then we're going to come back and get to the next leg of the journey.
My heart was filled with dread. Thank you.
Well, back from listening to Looks Like Rain, and we are going to jump into the early 80s, because, I mean, that's really when the magic kind of started coming down more in droves for you. So please share some stories about what happened next.
Well, as I had said, I had already met Dick Latvala and Carol, and got into hearing a lot of music outside of shows, you know, from tapes that Dick shared. And then through my friend Zuni, who I had been in South America with, she had gone to Egypt with the Dead in 78, become very good friends with Nikki Scully. I was myself within a frog's eyelash of getting on that airplane.
Oh.
Because there were two seats at the last minute, and Zuni or Nikki called me, and the thing was, my daughter was with her birth father in South America, and I had no idea where they were, and if there were cell phones, I might have gone to Egypt, but there weren't, so I didn't. although I did go a year later with Zuni, Nikki, and another friend, Quilly Powers. Anyway, through two things happened through my friendship with Nikki and Rock, which was one was that my daughter, now our daughter, me and Dennis, got to meet Wavy and go to Camp Winter Rainbow, where she went from the time that she was six and had a mop on her head and was a nurse in the old clown's home in the year 2020, coming up, saying, "Shut up and eat your protein pellets, Wavy Gwavy." And, and so the Wavy thread of my life developed, which is very oriented toward music and charity and goodness and giving and compassion and so forth, and the kids' camp, which was just a great thing for the children. And also the kids' room at Dead shows. And I also had a business at that time importing clothing from Bali. Zuni and Nikki had a business importing things from Egypt. This is in the early 80s. We shared an office space on Marquardt Street in San Rafael. Now, that was right down the hill from where Rock and Nikki lived. And the downstairs apartment of the place that they lived was occupied by none other than Jerry Garcia. Yeah. So Jerry, Jerry being at that time a bachelor and not cooking too much for himself, would come up and have dinner with the Scullies. And I often, you know, had the pleasure and privilege of joining them for dinner and got to know Jerry a little bit. And what a great guy is all I can say. He was so funny and so knowledgeable about film, about music, about all of the arts, very acerbic, just a very, very open human being. Just a wonderful guy. I mean, you know, he, despite any, all of his personal demons, I sort of believe that if he could have played music in a little hole in the wall, maybe with Khan, anytime he wanted to, you know, if he could have just given up being Jerry Garcia and gone out in public and played music, we might have had him around for longer, but that's just, you know, my wishful thinking. Yeah. And one thing that surprised me about him was that I thought, well, my highest offering is a really good bottle of red wine. He did not like red wine. He didn't drink wine. He just liked the sweet stuff, like Black Russians with Kahlua and cream. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to think about it like that, because, I've read things about him and, obviously follow, about his life and his music. But, I mean, it's been said he was a reluctant leader. And I think that just kind
yes.
of, that as you're saying that, that's kind of what plays to mind, to me, is the reluctant leader, that he didn't want to necessarily be this person that people were following. But because he was special, it just just happened, you know, whether it was counterintuitive or not.
No. Absolutely. I mean, he had a charisma to him that really made him, I mean, in my opinion, humble opinion, a very, very special person of the 20th century. An unintentional leader, as you were just saying,
unintentional leader. Yeah.
Yes.
The Pied Piper, you know, without even really realizing it. I have a visual of my mind of the Pied Piper with the community, you know, all following the music. That's my mental thought.
The community amazed me. Okay. Because, I had never in my life been in a place where everybody was for something and there was nothing that they were against. They were just for. And that was really win-win and remarkable. And the relationship between the dead and the audience always has been that kind of win-win relationship. And, you know, in various places, Jerry enunciated that very thought. I was really impressed with the community. And I will also add about the kids' room. At that point in the early 80s, Rock was my sponsor and way of getting into shows. And Rock could get himself into trouble. And sometimes when Rock was in trouble, I would get into shows backstage by being Season's mom to the kids' room. Mickey has this great quote about how, they watch the kids so we can play the music. And it was also, you know, the Grateful Dead shows, both front and backstage, have always been, you know, filled with small ones and a family atmosphere. And that's an excellent quality of the whole scene, in my opinion, as well.
Wow, I couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely. I was a teenager when I busted onto the scene, but I definitely, even just as recently as seeing the Dead & Company show in Saratoga, my husband and I were standing behind this, maybe it was like three families that were all together, and there must have been, you know, I don't know, 12 to 15 kids between the ages of, you know, baby and maybe 11, and just so much fun watching the kids and they're in the wagon and, you know, they're just being kids. Like it's just like a little playground for them, like doing their thing and, you know, dancing, then fighting over, you know, the glow stick whatever kids do, you know, and, alive and well, you know, and it's such a huge, it's awesome. Well, let's hear some music. 'Cause then I want to get into the mid-80s.
Okay.
So the next song that you selected comes to us from the Berklee Community Theater, which must have been, oh, I'm sorry, no, it comes from the Warfield.
The Warfield, Warfield.
The Warfield, and it was the set of shows that they did in 1980. And so this is a fun, tell us a little bit why you picked this and about how easy it was to pick one concert after the other because of a certain circumstance.
The first set of this long run at the Warfield was always acoustic, and Jerry insisted on ending it with Ripple. And in some of the shows, you would hear Bobby trying to get something else happening, some other song, you know, One More Saturday. I mean, you know, whatever, a Bobby song, and or Don't Ease Me In, or whatever. And but Jerry always insisted on ending that first acoustic set with Ripple, and of course, it's one of the most beautiful Dead songs, so that's part of why I picked it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I was picking it. I think first we talked 10-10, and then I was like, or 10-11, and you're like, you can pick any of those shows. And it was Ripple Acoustic at the end of the first set for the whole run. So I found a nice copy, and I did pick 10-11. So the October 11 from the Warfield. So let's go in and hear this, and then we're going to come back and hear a little bit about the mid-80s.
Okay.
Listening to the beautiful acoustic Ripple from the Warfield. And now that was 1980, and we kind of dipped a little bit into the early 80s, but I love that you have, you know, a big section in your book early on that says the 80s. So I want to jump into that decade with you right now.
Okay, yeah, I divided the book up, you know, into three sections: on stage, off stage, backstage, and in rough chronological order. And in the 80s, was the time I really got closer to the band, because one time in 84, I had been going to shows and so forth, and one day Jerry, not at a show, probably at Scully's house, said to me, "Hey, man, you and McNally ought to get together." Now, Dennis had just started working as the publicist for the Grateful Dead. He had already been the historian. I had met him. Dick had originally brought him over to my house. He got along great with my daughter. He helped her write her English papers. She went to two. She's a double Ivy, and she writes grants for nonprofits now. And I think a lot of that is Dennis's wonderful influence. But you know, we were just friends. I had kind of given up on men and relationships at that point in my life, and trying to keep a steadier keel. But then Jerry says this to me: "Hey, man, you and McNally ought to get together." So I thought, well, why not give it a try? And here we are, 31 years later.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Celebrated Valentine's Day last night.
That's right.
still, the bloom is still on the rose.
Yes. You know, like roses, it has its seasons, but the bloom is
still. There's a thorn here and there, but you can just kind of pick them off, okay.
Right. But, and I asked Jerry to walk me down the aisle because my dad had died when I was young, and my surrogate dad, my friend Zuni's father, was out of the country. So I thought, well, you know, Garcia's kind of responsible for this. I mean, I had only been hippie married before that, not legally. And he agreed to do it. I told him he could walk on water because we got married at a club called the Oasis, and it had a covered swimming pool. So we did kind of walk on water. But before, my funniest story before, which was kind of right a couple of months before we were married, in June of 85, it was the Grateful Dead's 20th anniversary at the Greek Theater in Berkeley. And the Greek Theater is such a great venue. It was the band's favorite venue, and so many press conference. I had the great good fortune of standing next to a total doofus, who raised his hand and said, "I understand you guys are all on drugs all the time, especially when you play. Are you on drugs now?" Dead silence. He asked the question again, this time a little bit louder. This time Jerry says, "You know, I see his lips moving, but I don't hear anything." So the doofus asks the question again, this time really loud, and they all turn their heads, you know, to stare at him in aghast amazement. And since I was right next to him, I snapped the picture, so it looks like they're all looking at me with this really, you know, intense expression on their faces. And that was what was going on during that photograph. And the other special thing to me about that photograph is how the five of them, Jerry, Mickey, Billy, Phil, and Bobby, are all sort of together. And Brent, there's a separation with Brent, and it kind of was indicative of the psychic separation that was always there with the keyboard players, particularly during my time. And sad, because I like Brent a lot, and he was my guy during the 80s, and so.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's probably one of my favorite pictures in the book, because you know they're all giving just this baleful stare, but they're kind of like, you can see some. They're laughing and serious at the same time.
That's
like, there's
right.
There's laughter in their eyes, but they're stone face at the same time.
Right.
You know,
right.
Conveying this juxtaposition of like, "Fuck you," but we're gonna smile all at the same time. That's a great picture.
Yeah, it's all there.
It's all there.
Absolutely.
No, that's awesome. I love that. Well, while we're at 85, and the song you picked, I mean, all the songs are beautiful, and all of the songs, the lyrics resonate. But the next song that we're going to play from that time was actually in Berkeley Community Theater, which I announced a few minutes ago. And it was in March, so March 9th, 1985, and The Wheel. And, I mean, gosh, that song is just so poignant to what's happening in your life at this time.
Exactly, exactly. And I will add that during that set of shows, Dennis did took my name on the guest list, like he had promised to. So that was the first test, okay, before taking Jerry up on his suggestion. And Dennis told me that he would take me to a special place in the building that I couldn't get to otherwise. So he took me way, way, way up into the rafters. But it was all very quick that it happened. He said, come on, we're going to go now. And I had a wide-angle lens on my camera. And so the guys were very tiny little figures on the stage because it was a long way away. So that got me into starting to do double exposures because I zoomed in on the skeleton rows and on the lights. And at that time, used a slide duplicator to do this much easier in Photoshop, I will add. But anyway, my life was changing and the wheel was turning, yes.
Yep, you're bound to cover just a little more ground.
Bound to cover just a little more ground, yep.
Fantastic. Well, let's hear it. After we talk about a song, I always get excited about wanting to play it because then I start humming it in my mind and figure everybody wants to hear it. So
okay.
we're gonna go in and play that, and then when we come back, we've got a couple more stories and a couple more songs.
Okay.
Well, back from listening to The Wheel, and you and Dennis are married now, and so legally family. And, you know, we talked a little bit about, like, the deadheads, you know, in the community before, but so now you're part of the family. Tell me, tell everyone, what's that like?
Well, it was amazing and wonderful. I realized the enormity of it when first in the Bammies in 88, everybody was there, and it was multi-generational. There was Eileen Law and Cassidy Law, Basha Razin and Melissa Razin, and so on. There were the sound guys. There was Cameron and John McIntyre, management guys. And Dennis was the publicist and historian, but at that time I had let go of the historian, was publicist. It was really remarkable. I kind of at that time got the idea that I had this terrific access and I should be documenting this. Never to be intrusive or violate anybody's privacy or secrets or anything like that, but to just share the good family nature of the whole thing. And Gerald and Brenda Elias was one of my inspirations for doing this with her Grateful Dead family album book, which I have a few pictures in. But in the late 80s, I kind of took it on myself to be a documentarian of anything that I could around that scene, and there were quite a few things that I could. And one of them was to be a still photographer for one of the days in the Hell in a Bucket video shoot. And that was really fun, with everybody dressed as devils, and Steve Parrish having makeup put on. And, you know, it was performance, so he couldn't tell me to get away with my camera. Steve was really, the crew were not fond of being photographed. The crew were not the sweetest guys in the world, you know. I mean, they were on the stage. They did own the stage. That was true, because the band didn't want to deal with it, so they left it to the crew. And Dennis often said that the crew tolerated me because I was like an ant that carried more than its own weight in camera equipment. Also, being up close, you know, got me looking at the different looks between the guys in the band while they were playing. So I have this whole section called WTF Bobby, which is Jerry Bobby shots, with Jerry giving very, you know, with Bobby doing wild Bobby things and Jerry giving him various looks of WTF, amazement, amusement, laughing. So I have four or five pages that I edited Bobby Jerry photos into.
I love those pages. Those are such good pages. And then you have the picture that's really famous is the making the silly face picture, right? With the tongue out, you know, smiley face. That's in that little group, right?
With Bobby and Jerry sitting at a table.
No, that's
not in that group. The WTF is all on stage pictures. That one is, I think it's 89. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I know it's at Cal Expo. And for some reason, there was an impromptu press conference with Bobby and Jerry. I got to be there, and Ken Friedman and John Werner. Ken was the Bill Graham photographer, and John Werner is a great guy, great photographer, very close with Mickey, done a lot of work with Mickey. You know, and somebody probably said, "Give us a smile, Jerry," and he gave that look, you know.
Such a great picture. Oh, my God, I just love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It makes me smile just even thinking about it.
Yeah, no, he was there. He was interactive. I mean, he wouldn't necessarily, you know, give you the trite thing that you wanted, but he would give you something wonderful. And Jerry was, I don't think, that comfortable with his physical image, and he did not like pictures of himself. Nonetheless, once he was there, he was great. And you know, like anytime he saw me on the stage or in the photo pit, he would, you know, he would give me a smile or a look or something. And I felt very acknowledged. I felt wonderful about that. And also got some great pictures out of it, like the 126-93 Jerry in the Gray T-shirt singing Gloria in the encore. And that was, you know, that was access that I got to be there because it wasn't the first three songs, and it was the encore.
Amazing. I mean, he just has that. I mean, all of the pictures are just that benevolent teddy bear, smiley, you know, this like wise, smiley teddy bear feeling about it. You know, and then you have, to your point, the juxtaposition of Bobby, who, you know, in the 80s, I mean, was the rock star, you know? So he's got his shorts and his hairs, you know, he got the, I mean, he had all kinds of hairstyles, the pink guitar. I mean, there's just, you know, there is so much to what the fuck and laugh about because they were such a juxtaposition that just kind of made it, you know? I mean, so much fun. Well, I was in high school, 89. I was in junior year in high school, and I can vividly picture my childhood bedroom, my teenage bedroom, and I had like a big tie-dye tapestry, and then I had the picture of Bobby at Frost with the pink guitar and the black shirt, you know? It was like a glossy 8x10, maybe not a poster, but, you know, like a full-size picture, and I just totally laugh at the idea that, you know, instead of whoever was the, you know, teen beat, you know, guys at the time, you know, whatever it was, Menudo or, yeah, whatever it was. Like, I had like 44-year-old Bobby Weir, you know.
Well, you're approximately my daughter's age, I guess. And so she was really into Peter Gabriel at that time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that was all. I had the Bobby picture up, that little 8x10. There was no Bobby posters like the Farrah Fawcett or the Peter Gabriel. There were no posters, so the 8x10 glossy just had to do it, I guess, you know. I wasn't a big enough market share to make a poster. But so much fun. Well, there's one other. So the next song we picked kind of goes into another story. So I want you to tell us a little bit about, you had mentioned, you know, philanthropic endeavors and, you know, the got Bill involved with the rainforest. And
in 88, after their great success with In the Dark, the World of the Dead expanded and they met a man named Randy Hayes, who became a Deadhead, wasn't really at the time, but Randy was the ED of the Rainforest Action Network, and he gave me the great history of how they got involved with dinners at Bobby's house, with the Rainforest Action, with the Rainforest concert to save the rainforest. And the environmental movement, and there are two really good quotes from Jerry about this. One, that, okay, the Dead, and particularly Jerry, are historically apolitical and sure, just did not like getting into politics at all. Jerry said, no, this is not politics. This is survival. So that was one thing. And then somebody asked him why they were doing this, and he said, look, somebody has to do it, and it's really pathetic that it has to be us.
Very, very poignant. Absolutely.
Yeah. So they had this big benefit at Madison Square Garden in 1988 at the end run of the shows, and Jerry was very pragmatic in suggesting that they do it the last night when everything would be in place with the catering and the trucks and you know and they wouldn't have to have anything extra in terms of expense, so more money could go to the organization, which by then had become three organizations: Rainforest Action Network, Cultural Survival, and the third organization is Greenpeace.
Fantastic. Well, so the next song that we picked to play, you know, came out of the same background philosophy, and it was Barlow wrote, with friends, we can run. So tell me a little bit about this pick from Shoreline.
Well, this song was really moving and really poignant. Brent sang it. I mean, because Brent, the Grateful Dead family, was growing at that time in terms of children, but Phil had two small ones, and Graham and Brian, and Brent had two daughters. So we don't own the world, though we act like we did. It belongs to the children of our children's kids. And he just pours his heart out in that, singing that song in June at Shoreline. And then he was going to pass so shortly after that. I mean, the adding to the tragedy of the whole thing of what's happened to the environment and what happened to Brent, but it was very moving that they carried on the thread from the benefit at Madison Square Garden with creating this song, although it was not a favorite of Deadheads.
It's such a beautiful song, and you know, you and I talked briefly about this before. What's interesting is, you know, what was played then, or what was thought about then in the late 80s or the 90s, and now going forward, gosh, you know, 25, almost 30 years later. And I think that Brent would be really happy to know that it is definitely in the rotation when people look back and think about things that were meaningful and where
uh-huh,
our world is now.
Uh-huh, yes.
I think this is the third, it's definitely the third, it might be the fourth time this song has been played on my podcast. That's, you know, that's saying something for pick your top three songs, you know? So,
right.
I mean, so the imprint has been made in the consciousness, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, that much later on, and that's beautiful, right? You know, that it,
yes,
that it's had that impact, and that, you know, as somebody who's talking to people in 2017, you know, it's around and it's strong and it's made its impact. And
that's right. That's right.
It, you know?
And we got to keep working on it.
We do. And
we do.
That was the point of it.
Yeah. You know, Jerry asked Randy Hayes, and after this had happened, said, "Hey man, give me a bunch of your business cards because I want people to talk to somebody who really knows about the environment because I am getting more questions about this than anything else."
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we don't need to get into where we are now, but we need to keep playing the song and hearing it and going forward. Well, let's everybody enjoy listening to Brent sing We Can Run from Shoreline Amphitheater on September 29th, 1989. And we will be back with a couple more stories and another song. Enjoy.
Belongs to the children of our children's kids. The actual owners haven't even been born yet. But we never tend the garden and we rarely pay the rent. Most of it is broken and the rest of it is bent. Put it all on plastic and I wonder where we'll be when the bill's in. We can run, but we can't hide. We only got one, we gotta ride on it. Whatever we've done, we'll never get far from what we leave behind. Baby, we can run, 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 but we can't hide. Well, I'm dumping my trash in your backyard, making certain you don't notice really isn't so hard. You're so busy with your guns and all of your excuses to use them. Well, it's all for the rich and babies for the poor. We got everyone believing that more is more. When reckoning comes, maybe we'll know what to do then. We can run, but we can't hide from it. Of all possible worlds, we only got one, we gotta ride on it. Whatever we've done, we'll never get far from what we leave behind. Maybe we can run.
possible worlds. We only got one, we gotta ride on it. Whatever we've done, we'll never get far from what we leave behind. Baby, we can run, 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 but we can't hide.
Well, welcome back from listening to We Can Run, and now we are in the early 90s. So there's, I guess, some really amazing stories about in your book about the early 90s. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, my favorite thing in the 90s involved Mickey and the Giotto Monks. Giotto Monks are these guys that can sing a chord in their throat at the same time, which can't be done, but they can do it. And they're kind of the Dalai Lama's personal choir. And Mickey hooked up with them, and Mickey, together with Dennis, promoted their concert so that they made money in the United States. And in 1991, Mickey did recorded them at his house in Sonoma. My favorite picture in the book from that is Mickey with a vacuum cleaner, because Mickey respected the Monks so much that he vacuumed the carpet for them himself. And, and he has this look on his face in the picture. Oh, my God, I'm Mickey Hart, and I'm vacuuming the rug. It's delightful. But he had a really sincere love and caring for them and their tradition. And another one of my favorite pictures in the book is him wiring up the head monk, wiring up, putting the earphones on and wiring him up for sound. And again, I saw them again at Mickey's house in 95, and Jerry and his then wife, Deborah Coons Garcia, were there, and Governor Jerry Brown, because Carol Orbach Hart, Mickey's wife, wanted the governor to see this grove of redwoods that she wanted to have saved. She was running the open space nonprofit at that time, maybe still is, but certainly was at that time. So I have some wonderful pictures of them from that day, which was just so sweet, seeing the monks paddling around in the little lake, riding their bikes, chanting, giving out the white scarves or katas to the people who were there, seeing Deborah playfully choke Jerry with a scarf, whatever. And also in the 90s, having access to the vault as a photographer to photograph first Dick and then later on David Lemieux. So that was another special thing for me in the 90s.
The music, I mean, having the music in those hands and really knowing what to do with it is has really been, has been everything for future and the organization and the picks of the songs, and Dave has certainly done a great job with that role that Dick began. So it's so appreciated from the Deadheads for sure.
Absolutely. In another a medium, there's a great quote from Ansel Adams about his negatives being stored at the University of New Mexico. And he goes, well, they're templates. They're for the future. They're for other people to play with, and to make their own images from. And I think of Dead and Company when I think of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that brings me to, the end of the book, I loved the chapter at the end where you had all of like the amazing celebrations and things that happened, post the mid-90s. I mean, the weddings, Bobby's wedding, and new musicians that came in. The picture with Stu Allen and the kids all grown up. You know, you have
pictures.
And, I mean, it's so cool. I thought that was so special.
Thank you. Yeah. I am back being a fan of Dead and Company. I mean, I kind of dropped out of it for a number of years. There are a lot of politics that developed around the scene without Jerry's charismatic moral compass. Kind of thought, well, I had it great for a while and onward to other things. And then Dead and Company happened, and I felt the same wonderful magic all over again, and I can't wait to see them this spring.
Oh, so are you going to be at Shoreline?
Oh, you betcha.
Well,
I'll see you there, huh?
I will see you there, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I'm looking outside in the New England February, and I can't even tell you how all eyes are on you right now. Can't even tell you. Well, we have one more song to play, so let's play this. And this, I mean, the lyrics, all the songs you picked, I mean, so beautiful and full circle. So tell us about the last pick for the song from June 1990.
Is Stella Blue, and that's my favorite Grateful Dead song, so that's what I want to go out with. And all the years combined, they melt into a dream, and that kind of says it all, and God bless Hunter for his brilliant lyrics, Barlow too for those he contributed, but you know, this in this case it's Hunter, and say pay on to the guitar. Stella Blue is a guitar and the music, and makes me think of Jerry.
Yeah, no, it's so beautiful. And, you know, in perfect, all things that touch, you know, the dead and the family and all aspects, past, present, and new. I love how we started off this conversation talking about how we met at Dark Store Orchestra and how you're going tonight. And we're ending with a show at Shoreline, and had just said that hopefully we will see each other in June at
yes.
Shoreline. So that is a completely organic, full circle conversation that starts off, you know, where we met,
yes,
and finishes,
yes,
where we'll see each other again. So
yes,
I love the way that just happens every time.
I love the way that just happened too, for our conversation and the fact that it's happening.
Yeah, no, it's again. I always say to my kids, I do believe in magic, and and the Grateful Dead, and not just the Grateful Dead, but the Dead and the Deadheads and the community and the energy and all of the lyrics and, you know, past, present, future. That to me is evidence of magic when you just look for it. So I don't know. That's how I feel, and I'm sure you do too.
I do too. Yes.
Well, so let's. That being said, I don't think that we could end with anything more special than the song. So let's do the traditional sign off goodbye, and then I'm going to go into Stella Blue, and then that'll wrap up the podcast.
Okay. Okay, Stacey. That's
Jerry.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, and I'm sure I'm going to be so happy to hear your stories, and have fun tonight, and I can't wait to see you in June.
Okay, it was great. It was great being on the podcast with you, and thanks for inviting me to share my stories.
And for everyone listening, the book, I am going to put the links onto the website, but just do a quick plug on where to find it or any pertinent information that people need to know.
Okay, it's called Alive with the Dead, A Fly on the Wall with a Camera. Mickey has written the foreword. Dennis has made some contributions to it in writing, and it's 25 years of my photos and of being a fly on the wall with a camera, and you can find it on my website, which is mamarazzi, mamarazzi.com, so you can buy it directly from me, or you can buy it on dead.net.
Well, there you go. Well, I'm going to put the links onto the website with this. But for anyone who's not going to the page, who's just listening to this podcast, I want to make sure to get all the particulars out there on the airwaves. So
okay, thank you.
I love my book, and you signed it. So
yay. Okay. I'm happy. I'm happy that you do. I had so many great memories, and you know, I really wanted to share them. So I'm glad I've done that.
Well, everybody enjoy listening to Stella Blue from June 17th, 1990, at the beautiful Shoreline Amphitheater, and thank you so much for tuning in. Bye.
Bye.
I've seen Everybody is praying in the heart of gold.